Okay, 1 week to go. It's all horse race all the time here at Deep Background. We take a look at those big Kansas races, and we'll dip into Medicaid for just a second or two, too. I'm Dave Helling. You are on Deep Background. Well, greetings. You're on Deep Background for July 28th, 29th. 2020. Dave Helling with the Stars editorial board. Derek Donovan, my friend and colleague and co-host, joining us, and Brian Lowry from Washington, a political reporter extraordinaire. Brian, always great to have you on the pod. Thanks for having me. Yeah. Now, so, okay, it's all horse race all the time, okay? All this policy and all that, not out the window. We're all about the horse race in this edition of the podcast because people are voting now, and of course, Election Day is next Tuesday. So, Brian, let's go in reverse order and talk about some of the races you've worked on, and just give us your own views of where the race stands in each of these campaigns and what we need to be looking for. Let's start in Kansas 2, where you have a three-way race for the Republican nomination, including an incumbent who is under some stress, and then two challengers. Walk us through that one.
I think this is the most interesting race in the nation right now. I think this was kind of in the background, and I think it has, at this point, it surpassed the Senate race. It's absolutely fascinating. Steve Watkins faces voter fraud charges that were announced just minutes before the candidates did a televised debate. I interviewed him this morning. He admits that he voted at the wrong address. He voted at the address for a Topeka UPS store. What he disagrees with is that he's committed a felony because he's saying he did it inadvertently, that it was an error. So he's just essentially asking people to forgive him this one. But one thing that makes that very difficult is that Kris Kobach, who is in another race that we're going to be talking about, prosecuted people for several years in Kansas under very similar circumstances.
Yeah, the other thing that makes it difficult is Steve Watkins is a congressman.
Right, the incumbent. and I said to him this morning, how as a congressman can you explain to your constituents that you could screw up something as fundamental as a voter registration form? And he obviously says it was inadvertent, but he's also saying that it was a collegial effort, which is very strange that this would be a collegial effort in the office. I actually had to confirm this morning with Roger Marshall and Sharice Davidson's offices that they helped their bosses fill out voter registration forms. So it's a very bizarre case. It hit at a terrible time for Watkins, though there is a question of, you know, is this coming a little bit too late to actually knock him out?
Well, let's talk about the other candidate.
Turner, who is the treasurer, who Watkins alleges this is all a elaborate conspiracy to maintain, he's obviously had a pretty good nest egg going in the campaign. It was all from his Senate campaign. He hasn't raised a lot of money, so he doesn't really have the resources to fully capitalize. He has been the most aggressive, and he does have key endorsements. Kansans for Life, which is a very influential group in Republican primaries, has given him the sole endorsement. He had given a dual endorsement, but withdrew that from Watkins after the felony charges. And then the other candidate who probably won't win, but is just a very fascinating person, is Dennis Taylor. And we're going to have a story coming out this week that looks in depth at all of Watkins' challengers. But, you know, Dennis Taylor served in multiple Republican administrations, was chief of staff to Governor Mike Hayden, was Sam Brownback's first secretary of administration, and warned him that if he wanted to cut taxes as much as he wanted to, he was going to have to cut spending, and Brownback didn't listen to him.
Yeah, we should point this out, that Dennis Taylor may also end up on your editorial page in that race, because he's a fascinating guy, isn't he?
And also spent some time in Eastern Europe, actually, after the end of the Cold War, was working for USAID, helping set up local government administration in Eastern Bloc countries, essentially teaching the bureaucrats who had worked under communism how to run democratic city council meetings and similar things like that. So absolutely fascinating life story. And then whoever wins the Republican nomination will face most likely Topeka Mayor Michelle De La Isla, who also absolutely, like, her life story, she was She was homeless in Puerto Rico as a 17-year-old and has this very interesting journey to become the mayor of Kansas's capital city. So I think both because of the how strange this case is involving Watkins, and that all of these figures, opposing him, including Jake LaTurner, who's the youngest statewide official in the country, they all come from really interesting backgrounds.
Yeah, we need to be
very tight, and so this is one to watch for sure.
Before we move on, Steve Watkins was supposed to lose the primary 2 years ago and did not. He was supposed to lose the general and did not. So there are consultants who have misjudged him immensely. And for all the scandal, he is the incumbent and he's in that race.
He could certainly eke out a win. And he could definitely eke out a primary win. And because he is, as you say, the incumbent Republican. So it's going to be a situation where we're either looking at an open seat race, which means it's anybody's game again, or the Republican nominee is going to be an incumbent who is grappling with criminal charges brought by a Republican prosecutor.
Yeah, no question. Okay, let's move on to Kansas 3. Five-person Republican field there trying to take on Sharice Davids in the fall. Three women, two men. Most of the attention, Brian, as you know, is focused on the three women, Adrian Foster, Amanda Adkins, and Sarah Hart Weir. Horse race. Where does that one stand?
So I think its key is that Amanda Adkins has not only raised the most money in this race, she also has a super PAC that's being funded primarily by her father, who is Alan Landis, who is former president of Herzog Construction, who any of your Missouri listeners probably know is a big deal in the adjacent state. And so she has the most resources right now that are working for her, both her own and the resources in this PAC. They are running very aggressive attack ads against Sarah Hart Weir. Both Weir and Adkins had laid down a lot of work for this race early on. We're both seen as very high-level recruits from the NRCC that was really interested in taking back this seat, which is in a Republican-leaning district, but a district where neither party really has the strongest foothold. It's a plurality. However, that said, the NRCC told me this week that it's not determined yet whether or not it's going to spend in this race in the general election. So it may be because of the national map as the Democratic field, potential for Democratic pickups expands, that the NRCC is maybe a little bit less invested in this race than they were just 6 months ago. So
is there a chance that that Foster and Adkins could sort of take each other, Sarah Hart Weir and Adkins could take each other out and create a lane for Adrian Foster?
For Adrian Vallejo Foster.
Yeah.
Or Tom Love, perhaps. And Adrian Vallejo Foster has certainly been working hard to reach out to the grassroots activists. She's got an interesting background. She's the former mayor of Park, and I think one thing that she's known in the recent debates is she's also a woman of color. So if she was the nominee, it would be pretty fascinating to see that both general election nominees in the state of Kansas be women of color.
We've talked a lot about Donald Trump. We'll talk about this here and then take a break. But how does Trump play in the 3rd District? You could make the case that Kevin Yoder lost because he could not create any daylight between himself and Donald Trump. The new nominee is going to face the same dilemma.
If you had Kevin Yoder on your program, I think he would probably make that case.
I think it's legit,
It's absolutely true. It's absolutely true, Dave.
And a complicating factor to that, too, is the front runners in that race right now are ideologically much closer to Donald Trump than Kevin Yoder was.
Yeah, it's the irony. This is where the primary system gets you, because to win the Republican primary, you really do need to embrace the conservative side, and you need and that has meant tangibly embracing Trump and all of the candidates, and you had them on 4-Star Politics for a debate. All of them gave Trump very high marks and were very resistant to criticize anything that he's done. So all of the Republicans have been very strong in pressing their pro-Trump credentials in a way that Yoder didn't have to last election. And so then now, you know, those are going to be statements that David's campaign and the Democrats could use against them in the general election. And this is not to take anything away from Sharice David, who obviously ran a very strong campaign in 2018. But, you know, when we talked to voters at the polls in 2018, many of them told us that they were voting for David's to send a message to Donald Trump and send a message about Donald Trump. So as long as he's at the top of the ticket, it's tough to see how that dynamic changes.
Right. And you know, I think the calculus a year ago was from Republicans, we need to nominate a woman in that district. That's, you know, Sharice Davis is a woman. We have to have a woman. It's more complicated than that, seems to me.
Correct. And I mean, it's you know, it will be an interesting thing to watch David's as an incumbent. They will have votes they can attack her on, but she's also going to have pieces of legislation that she can point to that she, even if she wasn't the sole sponsor of them, that she had a hand in that she can, that she's been a part of. So it's a fascinating race. I just think it's been actually having trouble getting oxygen to some degree between how competitive the Senate race is and how bizarre these adjacent second district races. Yeah. I think some of these candidates are having a little bit trouble penetrating in such a crowded media environment.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that on the other side. Let's take a break. When we come back, the Kansas Republican primary to replace Pat Roberts. You're on Deep Background.
Hey there, this is Derek Donovan of the Kansas City Star editorial board, and we hope you're enjoying the podcast. If you like what you hear, help us support this podcast and the journalism that reporters at the Star do every day by subscribing. There's an easy way for you to do it. Head to kansascity.com/background. You'll even get a special discount just for being a Deep Background listener. By subscribing at that URL, you will get 3 months of unlimited digital access to The Star for $1.99 total. That's right. You get access to kansascity.com, the e-edition of the newspaper, our mobile apps, and more for 3 whole months, and it only costs you $1.99. That's a pretty sweet deal. Plus, you will be supporting journalism that makes a difference in Kansas City. So, go grab your computer or mobile device and head to kansascity.com/background. And hey, thanks for listening.
Okay, we're back on Deep Background. Dave Helling with the Star's editorial board. Derek Donovan also on that board, also a co-host of Deep Background. And our good friend and expert, Brian Lowry, joining us from Washington. Okay, we've gone over Kansas 2, Kansas 3. Not really anything on the Missouri side other than Medicaid expansion, which I think is going to pass. We'll come back to that in a Deep Background podcast after the election. But we do have to focus on the Senate primary. On the Republican side in Kansas, Brian, 11 candidates, all of them climbing over the other to be the most conservative in the race, with the exception probably of Brian Matlock. We can talk about him in a minute. But what's the dynamic there? The conventional wisdom is, of course, Chris Kobach and Roger Marshall, the favorites, with Bob Hamilton a spoiler, David Lindstrom a spoiler. Is that wisdom right?
Not to be boring and just accepting the conventional wisdom, but I think that's really how you have to think about the race right now, which is it is essentially a race between Chris Kobach and Roger Marshall, but Dave Lindstrom and Bob Hamilton are relevant because Roger Marshall needs every possible vote he can get, which is why it actually struck some people a little bit odd that Marshall was running attack ads against Hamilton, during this race. Right. But that was actually because I think he was trying to, you had this candidate who was trying to run an insurgent campaign to be the Kobach alternative. And I think Marshall was trying to go after him fairly early. Hamilton's completely self-funded. He's put in $3.5 million of his own money as personal loans
to date.
For the first 2 weeks of July, when you had a pre-primary filing, he only raised a little more than $1,000 during that period. So this is his own money that he is spending on all of these ads that you are seeing is incessantly in the Kansas City area market. So if it pays off, the guy bet on himself big. But most likely he'll likely finish in third behind Kobach and Marshall, who it's just very tough to say for me right now who has the edge. I don't think that if Marshall and the Republican establishments felt that they had gotten it all the way over the top, you'd be seeing this flurry of activity. You're seeing
endorsements, that type of thing.
Endorsement from Pat Roberts was adamant that he was going to stay neutral, but I think he was looking at the fact that either that Kris Kobach might be the next nominee. And I think Roberts hasn't hid that he's not the biggest Kobach fan, and the guy decided he wanted to pick his successor, and he rolled that out. And you know, the Senate Leadership Fund, which is the PAC very closely associated with Mitch McConnell, put in $1.2 million into the race real late. But part of the reason they're doing that is because there's also these forces that are coming in to help Kris Kobach. One is Peter Thiel, who is a longtime friend of Kris Kobach, who is funding this Free Forever PAC. But there's also this more mysterious group called Sunflower State, which it seems to be a Democratic group that is essentially running Claire McCaskill's strategy from 2012, which is to build Kris Kobach up that he's too conservative, while also attacking Roger Marshall for being a phony. Yeah. And so I don't think either candidate is comfortable. Has a comfortable lead. It's very close as far as I'm concerned. I did find it a little bit strange when I actually had the pleasure of listening in to the editorial board's conversation with Marshall and some of the other candidates, that Marshall said he didn't want the Star's endorsement. Marshall is running he's got a coalition that's very similar to what Jeff Collier had 2 years ago. And one thing that the Collier people complained about 2 years ago was that the Star didn't endorse them and had endorsed Jim Barnett. So Marshall kind of needs everybody he can.
Well, do you think when Roger Marshall, Brian, looks back, regardless of what happens next Tuesday, he will think he might have done some things differently? I mean, Kobach is going to beat Kobach, and, you know, after he lost the governor's race, everybody said, oh, well, he's learned his lesson. He's going to raise money and be organized. He's done none of those things, really. But Roger Marshall needed to make himself better known here. In where I sit, Johnson County, Kansas.
Yeah.
And you get the sense, here we are a week out, that he's still an unknown quantity in a lot, now maybe not for most Republicans, but some. And that's where David Lindstrom and Bob Hamilton make a difference, because both of them are known in Johnson County. Well,
yeah, I think this is a case of where there's probably things Marshall should have done, but this is also, if I can actually expand it out, I think people who are really, if Kobach prevails, are going to really be kicking themselves, are actually the National Republicans, who spent more than a year on the
kicking him
to get Mike Pompeo into the race, and that ultimately failed. Now, some people might blame Pompeo for resisting this, but you really hampered all of the other Republican candidates, save probably Kris Kobach, from doing the races that they would do otherwise. Susan Weigel, who ultimately decided not to file, has been very upfront about how that having the shadow of Pompeo hang over the race has made it impossible to fundraise. I think that probably hampered Marshall's fundraising. I mean, Marshall has only been the establishment pick for about a month, right?
Right.
You know, up until June.
And not only that, Brian, he's the default pick, right? He's the first district congressman. If he could be a baked potato, and they're going to endorse him because he's the heir apparent and all those other things. And he's not Kobach.
Up until about June 1st, McConnell was publicly telling people that he wanted Pompeo to get in. And so there could have been more of an effort by the National Republicans, who have now embraced Roger Marshall, to maybe help get him on stronger footing early. Now, they might say that he hadn't shown up until that point the things they needed to see in terms of fundraising and messaging, that he hadn't shown whatever he needed to get them to do that. But you do have to wonder how much as much as there's been accusations of folks trying to meddle from the party apparatus to help Marshall the past couple of weeks, how much he was damaged by all of the meddling to get Pompeo in.
Right. I think, the broader question, and Derek, we talked about this at length in the editorial board when we discussed this race today. No one ever seemed interested in the Republican field, Brian, of carving out the moderate lane. You would think that there would have been an opening for one of these 11 candidates and maybe one of the top four or five to say, no, I'm not Kobach, but I'm also not Marshall. I'm not, Bob Hamilton. There's a Kassebaum, Dole, Dick Bond lane, and no one took it. No one.
Right. And we did see those types of candidates at the Kansas level, at the state level. We talked to several of those.
Right. And congressional level, Dennis Taylor, for example, who may not win, but people who it seemed like there was a lane. Susan Weigel wasn't going to fill it. Nobody ever filled it.
I don't know that I don't know that you could fill that lane and win the statewide primary. But to me, the more interesting question is, what's the effect that no one is in that lane? Yes. There's one right now at the top ticket. You're mentioning Dennis Taylor in the congressional race, but there's no one in the statewide race working to turn out moderate Republican voters. So to me, I really wonder what happens to moderate Republicans in those down ballot legislative races, because they need to get everybody out to vote for them themselves, because Kris Kobach, Roger Marshall, and Bob Hamilton are all working on turning out red meat conservative voters. Now, there's gradations within there. The folks who prefer Marshall are more business focused than the folks who prefer Kobach, who are more focused on immigration. But it's all been an effort to turn out conservative leaning Republican voters. So I do wonder what the down ballot effect is going to be, that you don't have a equivalent of Jim Barnett, or you don't have that moderate Republican voice at the top of the ticket.
What's interesting to me is, for example, it's clear that Roger Marshall wanted to say early on, I'm not Kris Kobach, but instead of saying, I'm not Kris Kobach, I'm more moderate, he says, I'm not Kris Kobach, I'm more conservative than Kobach. I mean, so the race to the right, and just your thoughts on this, Brian, it won't matter if the nominee, whoever it turns out to be, beats Barb Boyer. If that happens, which has happened for 80 years, whatever the math is, then I think the Republicans will continue to have these fights. If Boyer wins, don't you think there's a reckoning coming?
Oh, for sure. And what I would say, there's a couple things to respond there to, but Marshall at the Times has been saddled with the moderate label, even though he votes with Trump 98% of the time, which is the most out of any member of the Kansas delegation of either chamber in Congress. And that's because he beat a more conservative candidate.
Tim Hills. You cannot be more conservative than Tim.
In 2016, but he's by no means obviously a moderate. But there will be, I think certainly if Kobach wins, and then and for the second election in a row loses to a moderate Democratic female candidate, there will obviously have to be a reckoning within the Kansas GOP about running these more ideological candidates at the top. But, what I would say is there's also a possibility that Marshall faces a close race. The conventional wisdom is that Marshall would shore this race up for Republicans. That it becomes a toss-up with Kobach, and maybe it's not a slam dunk with Marshall, but that it's a lean R to maybe even solid R race. But if Marshall has a close race with Boyer, there's going to be people in Kobach's wing of the party that says, see, there's a lack of enthusiasm. Yep. See, like we told you so. So, I mean, we'll see how that works out. I mean, Boyer is going to mount perhaps the most competitive campaign by a Democrat since the 1930s, at least since the 1970s, when Dole had that very close race
with Bill Roy.
But I still think you need to consider her the underdog. It's kind of it's it's kind of tough to think about it that way when she has 8 times as much money as Kobach and 4 times as much money as Marshall. But she is fighting an uphill battle, and she's going to have to use every single one of those dollars. And there will be a flood of Republican money that comes in to support the nominee, whoever it is. It's just, I think, one thing national Republicans are concerned about is they might have to spend a little bit more if it's
right. That's true. Although I would guess that if it's competitive at all, the Dems will have some third party money coming in too, to try to help her, because they think she might be, or this might be the seat that turns the Senate Democratic in 2021. Okay, let me ask you one final sort of broad question and we'll call it a day. Kraske and I were sitting in the Star's newsroom probably 8 years ago, taking a look at Kansas politics, and we saw a collision coming in the Senate race to replace Pat Roberts. And that collision was Kevin Yoder against Mike Pompeo, against Tim Huell's camp, against Lynn Jenkins. Yeah. And we were sure that's what was coming. And right. Here we are in 2020, and they're all not in the race, and only one is still in politics.
And see, that's
amazing to me.
That's the timeline. If Hillary Clinton had won, right, Mike Pompeo would still be the congressman from Wichita. He wouldn't have had these opportunities to serve as first CIA director and secretary of state. Kevin Yoder most likely would have retained his seat in 2018. And, you know, who knows what would have happened with Huell's camp. But and
Jenkins, right?
Jenkins may have still decided to retire her the same time she did, but certainly, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that we were likely to see Kevin Yoder and Pompeo go toe to toe, maybe one of those other members in a race. But that all hinged on, you know, that's a different timeline. We don't live in that time.
Right, and I guess that's my point, really, is that what we think is absolutely certain in politics has a half-life of about 24 hours, right? I mean, when we go through all of this horse race stuff, people have a weird way of making a decision.
It shows you how the impact of Trump's election on a red state's politics, in that it allows for someone like Mike Pompeo to leapfrog into a higher position, maybe much sooner than he could have. It led to the elevation of Kris Kobach to build a national profile to him in some significant ways, and probably helped him, you know, certainly Trump's tweets helped him win the primary for governor 2 years ago. So it really is that.
But hurt him in the general, presumably.
But it really did shift the direction of Kansas politics. And it also meant that we had to say goodbye to your beloved Sam Brownback. He got that ambassadorship position. So,
well, right. And just as long as we're talking about that, the retirement of Pat Roberts is part of that, too. I mean, Pat, you know, that whole cohort, if you will, of Republicans, Brownback, Roberts, leaving the stage. The other people that you thought were on the bench are no longer on the bench, and you're left with this maelstrom that we've seen this year.
Now, Roberts is very fond of telling people that he's 24-0 in elections. And if this seat does go blue, you know, after Roberts says, you know, 24-0 includes his U.S. House elections, obviously. If this seat does go blue, I wonder how many people like Pat Roberts is going to say to, I could have won it. So.
Yeah. Well, I've known Pat since 1980. I know exactly what he would say. Brian, I appreciate it so much. Be a fascinating day next Tuesday. And then it's a 90-day sprint to the finish line, where the contrast, as they say, will be much more clear in Kansas and in every state in the union. It's so good of you to be here. And we'll, of course, reach out to you again and again as we get closer to Election Day. Derek Donovan, thank you again so much for being with us and running the board here at the podcast. And good luck. Everybody get out and vote. As they used to say, vote early and often. So
thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Thanks, Derek. I'm Dave Helling with the Star's editorial board. You've been on Deep Background.